Hello, good morning and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg and it's my great pleasure to be hosting you this morning, 30th of October, and it's a Wednesday all day. We have got another really fascinating program coming up for you. We'll be kicking off with Piet Viljoen from ReCM, then Evan Walker of 361, both of them giving us some insight into the latest developments on the market-moving news. Then we go to California, where Anthony Ginsberg is waiting for us to explain to us what's going on with the Alphabet results. They shot the lights out. Then we will be picking up on a story from yesterday with Gerard van Deventer. He's the Divisional Executive for Enforcement at the Financial Services Conduct Authority. If you were with us yesterday, you would have heard our anonymous insider or whistleblower telling us that Bankso, which is suspended from operating, appears to still be doing business. And then we close off with booming Bitcoin. Jason Wells is the head of crypto at Geltech. He'll be giving us insights on why crypto is going running like a scalded cat. So lots coming up in the next hour. But first, let's kick off with the overnight news from our partners at Bloomberg. Here's Charlie Pellett and team.
Dueling closing arguments. Vice President Kamala Harris in Washington on the National Mall.
Donald Trump intends to use the United States military against American citizens who simply disagree with him. People he calls, quote, the enemy from within. America, this is not a candidate for president who is thinking about how to make your life better. This is someone who is unstable, obsessed with revenge, consumed with grievance, and out for unchecked power.
Donald Trump in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Less than 4 years, Kamala has shattered our middle class. You notice I don't mention Joe. Crooked Joe, he's so crooked, it's hard to believe.
As for the U.S. election and investor sentiment, Lori Calvesina is head of U.S. equities at RBC Capital Markets.
You know, generally, my U.S. long onlys, they feel confused about what the outcome is going to be. They're not entirely sure. We have a great playbook for what you do in the different outcome scenarios. And they are talking, but, you know, I don't get the impression that they're trading a lot on it. I think they're trading on earnings right now.
Calvesina was interviewed on Bloomberg Television. Google parent Alphabet reported third quarter sales that climbed more than analysts expected, helped by the growth of its cloud computing business. Aaron Kessler is a senior analyst with Seaport Research Partners.
I think the big number that stood out to me was the 35% cloud growth. We were looking for about 29% growth, similar to last quarter. So that was very strong in terms of the cloud growth.
Sources tell Bloomberg Siemens is close to agreeing to a deal to buy software maker Altair Engineering in what would be its largest ever acquisition. The story from Bloomberg's Erica Herskowitz.
Charlie, sources tell Bloomberg the German engineering group is putting the finishing touches on a transaction that could be announced as soon as Wednesday. Bloomberg News reported last week that Siemens was in talks to buy Troy, Michigan-based Altair. Led by founder and chief executive officer James Scapa, Altair provides engineering software to companies in the aerospace, automotive, energy, and financial services industries, among others. Demand for such tools is expected to grow in lockstep with the increased adoption of artificial intelligence in everyday life. Charlie?
Bloomberg's Erica Herskowitz reporting. Among earnings reports, Meta platforms after the close of trading, what to expect? Mandeep Singh is a senior tech analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence.
Now they have a product to show with the Reality Labs investment, the AR glasses. But still, look, Meta is still an ad-dominated company. They don't have that diversification element. And the bar keeps getting higher. 20% growth rate when your comps get tougher. Like, how much can you beat and raise? Maybe they surprise us because they're executing very well, but that's where, because it's so dominated by ads, it's hard to find that lift in the earnings.
Mandeep Singh of Bloomberg Intelligence.
Pit Viljoen of RECM. Lovely to have you early in the morning, Pit. Thanks for joining us.
And you're
not just a guy who watches the markets or who puts together the insights on what to invest in and runs portfolios, but you've also got a couple of businesses that you're very intimately involved with. And I see one of them, Astoria, which yesterday on the Stock Exchange News Service came out with an announcement. Nobody better to talk to than you about it. First of all, what is Astoria and what was the news yesterday?
So Astoria is an investment holding company that was unbundled from another investment company which used to be called Reason & Caliber, which also owns Gold Rush, a gaming company. So what we did is we unbundled all the non-gaming assets out of Reason & Caliber into Astoria, which is a Mauritian domiciled business, kept the gaming assets in Reason & Caliber, and it's now called Gold Rush Holdings because the only asset is the gaming business called Gold Rush. And within Astoria, we have all the other the stakes in all the other businesses we own, such as Safari Outdoor, Isaac Carstens, Transex, et cetera. So Astoria is an investment holding company domiciled in Mauritius and managed by RECM Global.
And the news yesterday?
Well, it was just our quarterly results. So we because it's a Mauritian domiciled company with a listing primarily on the SEM, the Stock Exchange in Mauritius, we have to come out with quarterly results, and yesterday was the September quarter end results for Astoria, in which we we didn't revalue any of our unlisted businesses. We only do that every 6 months, but we mark to market all the listed companies like Liat and Liat and the Gold Rush Holdings, the two listed companies we own stakes in, and we just use the market price to value those.
And I see the shares don't trade that often on the JSE, but are they trading at a discount as most other investment companies are to the assets that are in there?
Very much so. We calculate the net asset value per share on a fairly conservative basis, and that comes out to just over 14 Rand a share, and it's currently trading at around 8 Rand 50 a share. So it's trading at a significant discount to what we think is a conservative NAV. The market might not agree with that, but that's what we think.
So Warren Buffett would say, here's an opportunity to buy a dollar's worth of assets for 50 cents. So I guess the story is just go and do your homework. But I asked you to come and talk to us today primarily on the Competition Commission. I had a very strong statement land in my inbox from Vodacom, who are pretty upset about the fact that the Competition Commission has blocked a massive investment it's going to make in a company called Maziv. This is the second time in the last few days that we've seen the Competition Commission block big deals. The other one was Sun International's proposed takeover of Peermont. Let's start with Vodacom and Maziv and exactly what's going on there and why the competition authorities might be upset, and are they right?
Well, I think one has to take a step back to understand what's going on here. And basically what we have is a tension between a socialist government who doesn't trust the market to allocate resources properly and thinks that they can allocate resources better by rules, regulations, and laws, and have constituted bodies like the Competition Commission and others to do their bidding. So that's a fundamental problem. The incentives in the market, in the marketplace, is to listen to or to be guided by Adam Smith's invisible hand to allocate resources to the most profitable ventures where clients' needs are serviced and they are willing to pay for those services. Whereas the incentive for commissions like the Competition Commission is to have more rules, more regulations, wider powers, and so on. So, and that's where the tension is. The result of that is the situation at Vodacom Maziv, where this deal has been tied up in red tape for 3 years. I think the first application to the competition, I can't remember, tribunal or commission, was in 2021. I mean, it's 3 years later, and now they come out with a ruling that no, you can't do the transaction. I just think it's completely ridiculous, and it's a sign of regulatory overreach that a decision would take so long. And then have come up with such a negative finding in a sector which is highly capital intensive and where you need scale to deploy that capital to the benefit of consumers to give them access to the internet, including consumers in townships. And these are things that the socialists in these committees don't take account of or don't seem to take account of.
So what are the options for Vodacom and the other partners? Remgro, I see, is also involved in this massive company.
I think they'll now go back and study the findings of the commission and see if they can come up with measures that can alleviate the problems that the commission has with the transaction. I don't know if that's possible. I haven't studied the whole document myself. I'm sure that Vodacom and its advisors and Remgro and its advisors will be burning the midnight candle to study those findings. So they'll try to come up with a plan to satisfy the Competition Commission and still carry on and still then be able to effect the merger or acquisition. Alternatively, it falls over, the transaction doesn't happen, and the constituents of Massive, which is, I think it's Vumatel and Dark Fiber, which have been rolling out fiber to the home massively with debt, could face funding problems and they could fall over and there'd be less competition in the fiber business, not more competition. There would be less competition if these businesses would fall over because of the high debt levels that they have.
So you need second level thinking at the Competition Commission, and it appears as though that isn't being implemented at the moment.
There's none of that.
What about Sun International and Pyrmont? That would seem, pretty open and shut case on the face of it, given that Sun International and is large and Pyrmont is one of the big three in that industry. You know it well because of your other investments. Yeah. What did you make of the Competition Commission refusal to allow Sun International to buy Pyrmont?
Again, I find it surprising. So I have not studied the documents behind the decision. So I can't speak to why they would have done it, but just standing, looking at it from outside, the gaming business, especially the casino business, are highly regulated. Licenses are allocated geographically. So casinos can't compete with each other in the first place because each geography has a license. So I fail to understand how Sun International's acquisition of Pyrmont will influence the competitive dynamics in the sector at all, because Pyrmont's casino has no competitor close to it at all because of the licensing requirements set up by the gambling board. So that's another surprising decision, which I don't understand at all. And all it does, it speaks of a regulatory overreach and the incentives behind why these commissions exist in the first place.
Interesting to note that Sun International's share price has actually gone up after the decision by the Competition Commission. So perhaps shareholders weren't that thrilled about the deal.
Pyrmont is another highly leveraged business. It is owned by a company that basically swapped debt for equity because of the highly leveraged situation. So it doesn't have the cash. All its cash flows go to servicing the debt, and it doesn't go into making the business better at this point in time. So I think if you look at Pyrmont's casino, it's probably not as well maintained and well kept as some other casinos. And again, the reason they're doing this transaction is because Sun International has deeper pockets and can apply capital to not only servicing the debt behind Pyrmont, but also to maintain the casino and to possibly expand it and create jobs even further. So again, what could happen here is that Pyrmont could fall over on its own and all the jobs will be lost and there'll be less competition in the casino sector. So again, second order thinking completely absent from such a decision. Not even second order thinking, business understanding the capital structure behind business and what sort of behaviors that creates.
Yeah, if you don't invest in it, and you think of it, if I'm sitting in cabinet, what the number one priority is, let's get investment into South Africa. A deal like this would would spark investment into, as you've said, the Piedmont Casino, just near the airport. And that yeah. would be something that Cabinet would say, great, we've got a South African business to put more money into the economy. Now the Competition Commission yeah. is saying, for reasons that perhaps it feels that there would be too much power with the Sun International Group, it's saying, no, we don't want to allow you to do that. And so it's going to be a unmaintained casino that is not going to attract the traffic or the taxes that it should. It's education ish. It's expensive if you don't have it, hey?
Yeah, I mean it's a ridiculous situation. You know you have here Piedmont is owned by offshore entities that provide the debt. So all the debt repayments, interest repayments, move offshore. Whereas if Sun International owned it, they would invest more into the business, make it more attractive for customers to come there. There'd be more tax payable to the government. It would be all around just a better situation. But, you know, the Competition Commission has, again, it's incentivized not by serving the interests of customers. It is incentivized by having more rules and regulations, having more power. That's the only incentive it has.
Pete, I know you're not always keen to talk about competitors, but Coronation Fund Managers did come up with this trading update yesterday. Do you look at things like that to see how well they're doing relative to you? I see the share price was it's up about 2.5% in the past week.
I think I should point out we probably don't compete with Coronation directly. At one of our associates, Merchant West, we have funds. Most of the funds are very different to the type of funds that Coronation runs. So I wouldn't say we compete directly, but we do fish in the same pond, so whatever happens to them is of interest to anybody else who does fish in that pond.
And your take on their trading statement?
Look, the asset management business is a tough business. And the trading statement just illustrates the fact that the assets are not growing. Profitability is flat, if you strip out the tax situation there. And it's just a reflection of how tough the asset management business is. The asset, as I said, the asset base is not growing because the savings of South Africa has not been growing over the past few years. Plus, because the asset management business was historically a very profitable business, it's been encroached upon by all sorts of other intermediaries like DFMs and financial advisors who are taking a bigger and bigger slice of the pie, leaving the asset management industry with less and less of that pie. Which, that's how the market works, and that's fair enough. But that is what is happening, and you can see the results of those competitive pressures plus the lack of growth of savings in the South African economy are reflected in Coronation's results at this point.
Piet Viljoen from RECM. As always, we love getting insights from our man. He's the only person who has presented at every single one of the BizNews conferences. Now with us is Evan Walker from 361. Also, his colleague, Sy Jacobs, has become a regular at the BizNews conferences. He'll be back again in March. Evan, I hope he's going to bring you down with him so you can come and whisper in his ear when we talk about retail issues. There's lots going on in the retail field. We had a jump in the ShopRite share price yesterday after a trading statement. And since we last spoke to you, we've had the results from Pick and Pay. Now, in bygone years, those would have been the two big retailers, the two big heavyweights that would be in the ring. Today, of course, it's like a heavyweight against a, I don't know, featherweight or mosquito weight, given the different fortunes of those two groups. But let's start off with ShopRite and your thoughts on the trading statement that the market seemed to love so much.
Hi, morning, Alec. Morning, everyone. Yeah, I mean, ShopRite was superb. I mean, we really didn't anticipate growth on the South African market in the 11s. We know inflation's coming down to sort of the 3, 4% mark. And we were looking for sort of volume growth around 2s with a bit of space growth. So we had sort of 8 penciled in, 8 to 9s. I think consensus was around 9.5. We were a little bit more conservative, just given, we can talk about Pick and Pay afterwards, but just given the fact that there has been a rising competition back in the SA market, there's been a bit of a recapitalization in Pick and Pay. Spar looks like they're trying to get their act together. So we thought there was a little bit more of a competitive element coming back in. But no, I mean, the big mammoth, the big Goliath, obviously ShopRite just dominating the sector continually and obviously taking more volume share, from its competitors and, doing a sterling job.
And I suppose when you get to the size of ShopRite, and it has been organically grown, they started with zero and they're now at a point where they really are the huge player in South Africa, you presumably have more money to reinvest into your business than the others have. So it becomes an ever more difficult race for them to catch up.
Yeah, it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, as you rightly say. I mean, ShopRite now is investing three times the amount of capital that its competitors are investing, you know, 9 billion versus sort of twos to threes from its competitor stable. So, you know, that's just incredible. And that's going into all parts of their business, from logistics, obviously, into, you know, their new 60-60 offering, their internet offering, which is unsurpassed. And, you know, given the amount of leverage in the market, they've been able to cap the fee. I mean, you can order as many times as you like from 60-60 for 100 rand a month now. So that's an effective, that's quite an effective discounting method back into your price points, Alec, if you think about it. I mean, you know, you don't actually have to drop your gross margins or drop your pricing. You just allow the customer to order again and again and again at an additional cost to you, you know. So it's quite an effective pricing mechanism in the market. And obviously, you know, that's you know, I think it's a very clever way to ensure that you're still getting in-store gross margins while you're attracting, obviously, your internet customer from your competitors in a very competitive landscape. You know, we seldom speak about the sort of mammoth we spoke about the other morning. Obviously, the Walmart stable as well, looking to sort of re-platform its macro business and realign its game businesses. And again, there, you know, we're hoping that they make some form of comeback. But at this point in the cycle, there's just nothing to stop ShopRite, and given the amount of investment and the fact that these are very clever guys. I mean, they have really studied this marketplace substantially. They know what they want to do. You know, they have, you know, active records on 30 million customers today. They are just very, very clever guys, and are really at this sort of forefront of technology, innovation, logistics. You can't fault them. And then, you know, what we've seen coming through more and more from these retailers, you know, similar to what we spoke about in Capitec, was just obviously offering more services to customers. So whether it's, you know, bank transfers, you know, all these types of little incremental payments coming through these retailers is just adding another level of service fees. And those are growing, you know, faster than actual retail spend at these retail checkpoints.
On to Pick and Pay, and we did use a boxing analogy earlier, which I think is appropriate here, because they've got the jewel in the crown being Boxer, which is in the process of being separately listed. What is that going to do for Pick and Pay as a whole, and particularly for Sean Summers with his attempted comeback?
Yeah, Alec, I think it puts back, you know, puts Pick and Pay back in a significant cash position. I mean, it had to be done. I mean, you saw the losses out of Pick and Pay, 700 million at the operating level for the half year. That's before, you know, obviously additional leasing costs, et cetera. So you saw the substantial losses at the half. I mean, obviously they're guiding for those losses to be substantially lower. In fairness to Sean, I mean, he's doing the right things. You know, his job is to come back and just turn Pick and Pay profitable again. He doesn't have to worry about market share. He just needs to get a business back to a level of profitability, and he needs to find an element of niche in the South African market. I mean, what I'm struggling with when I Pick and Pay and I walk through them, you know, often, and I look at the stores, as I just try to see and I try to think about it from Sean's perspective, is just how you entice a what I call a wow factor back into these stores. And I'm really struggling with that. But, you know, in fairness to him, you know, I think he's looking at the store profiles. He's looking where he can obviously, you know, suit the customer the best. And I think he's just going to have to be very strategically clever around, you know, what he does. But I mean, for me, it's how does he find this wow factor for Pick and Pay again, which obviously he had in the late 80s, 90s, and into the early 2000s. He had this substantial wow factor in Pick and Pay, which he lost to then Woolworths Foods, Spar Superstores, and then obviously Checkers as they came through the ranks and started obviously powering ahead from Pick and Pay and the likes of all the other competitors, just as they reinvested what was really mass market profits from the ShopRite division back into Checkers over all the years and developed that to such a substantial brand today.
There's a big lesson for all businesses there. Just don't fall asleep at the wheel. And when you don't, you just can't rest on the benefits of the past. What might those niches be? And I take you to very close to where we used to live. the Pick and Pay store just off the Nickel Highway in Johannesburg, in near Hurlingham Manor. That's a fabulous store, and it does appear to be competing with just about any other store that there is. But there aren't that many of them around in South Africa. Could that be a niche that they might go into, or are there other areas that they could fulfill? Because clearly, they're not going to beat Shoprite. Not a Shoprite's game.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I said, I mean, the Nickelway store, I mean, I lived in Fourways for most of my life. I mean, I'm down in the Cape now, but I mean, you know, it was a store we often visited, and there was numerous stores, Pick and Pay stores, that were still very good stores. But it's just a nuance, Alec, that you try finding these store layouts. If you see the new Shoprite stores, they've got a Starbucks in them, they've got all these sort of deli formats which I don't see popping up in the Pick and Pay. I mean, obviously Pick and Pay had this, but they've seemed to sort of flatline in this approach. But, you know, it's become sort of, Checkers has become sort of a store-in-store concept per se. And I mean, you know, I don't know what more you do to an operational environment, a store layout environment. I mean, I've traveled the world, fortunately, and been lucky enough to see stores all over the world. And ShopRite today, I think, is leading edge. I'm not saying all our retailers aren't leading edge. They're just doing a little bit of a better job. I think Woolworths Foods has still got a bit of a wow factor in it, just because its food is so classy. But I'm struggling to see where Sean can pitch his business and try to get this wow factor back. But in the intermediate, he is doing a better job. And I mean, we've seen better like-for-like sales growth coming through from him. I mean, obviously, he's culling a lot of underperforming stores. It's the right thing to do. You know, don't chase market share. Just chase profitability now. Get it back to where it can make money. He's going to have a substantially better balance sheet. I mean, Box is probably going to raise him, we think, in the upper end. Now, Box is going to be quite an exciting listing, Alec. I mean, it comes with another whole element of the market. And for once, yeah, there's a business in the Pick and Pay stable, Box, that actually competes with ShopRite. You know, so they neck for neck, you know, I would say probably at the bottom end of the market, a better retailer, funny enough, than ShopRite. They just seem to have positioned better in that bottom end of the market. They've got a big store rollout campaign still coming. They've got some big stores. I've traveled to a lot of parts of South Africa in the rural areas, and they've got some very big, exciting formats still coming. They've got a big property, you know, growth vector, which is still there for that business. So quite excited about this Boxer, but it's certainly going to give Sean, you know, a very, very big balance sheet to deal with this Pick and Pay issue, which is going to take time, obviously a couple of years. The analysts are sort of only predicting a 3 to 4 year turnaround to profitability on Pick and Pay, and that's going to be going some.
Evan, for those who aren't as close to the action as you are, Boxer at the moment is part of Pick and Pay. That's going to be separately listed. Can you buy Pick and Pay shares now and then participate in the separate listing of Boxer?
Alec, we're not sure. Okay, so we're not sure if you're going to – we don't think you're going to get a pro rata. Theoretically, they should do that. If you're a shareholder in Pick and Pay now, they should give you the first allocation. But I don't think it's going to work on that basis. It looks like it's going to be a bidding process. They're going to open up the listing. You're going to put in your offers, and you know, you're going to get allocated based on your price. So I think it's going to really be a price-based listing. So it's not going to be based on whether you're participating in Pick and Pay currently. So it's not like a rights issue. It's really going to be a new listing per se, where you're going to put in your offer price. So again, I mean, it's whether you buy Pick and Pay now and hopefully get an uplift in the Pick and Pay shares if Boxer rallies significantly and drags the Pick and Pay share up with it. We think there's a little bit still in the Pick and Pay price, but obviously it's run quite heavily from the low 20s, you know, up to where it is 26, 27. But if you have a big take up in Boxer, I think that can go a little higher, but not substantially higher, but I think it can go a little higher in that process. But you know, your first enter market would be to try get some Boxer shares. We think this is a good business, but again, it's going to be based on pricing and to what extent that multiple trades. You know, we don't think it deserves a ShopRite trading. We think it still deserves a bit of a discount, but again, it's going to be based on the market appetite at that point. It's towards the end of November we're going to see the final pricing on that.
Evan, thanks for sharing your insights with us. Evan Walker is with 361. Well, we're off to California now, and San Francisco, I believe. Anthony Ginsberg from Gins Global. Thanks for staying up late Anthony, lovely to see you and to be talking with you again on such a big day. The release of this week, we're going to see four of the Magnificent Seven giving us financial results. Last night, our time, I suppose just after the trading closed in the US, your time, the numbers were out from Google stroke Alphabet. It's known as Alphabet. The early initial reports we had was the market loved it.
The results were terrific, actually, particularly Google's cloud blew the socks off most expectations. Greetings from LA this morning, actually.
LA, sorry.
Google was up on their cloud earnings 35% year on year. Cloud is actually still in the early innings since we're in the middle of the World Series here in America. You know, there's nine innings in a baseball game. We're in the early innings of cloud still. Less than half of all IT spend is still being impacted by a cloud. And something like 20% of work enterprise IT only currently being utilized in the cloud. So for Google to have 35% year-on-year revenue was a huge beat on the expectations. Their earnings numbers were also up dramatically. Just to give you an idea, the revenues were up 15% year-on-year. Even YouTube and the search engine business, which many thought could suffer from chatbots and AI, because there were some concerns, you'll recall, over the last year or two with ChatGPT coming in, even those had double-digit growth numbers, both on the earnings, the bottom line, and the top line, Alex. So yes, Google's numbers were very impressive. They actually, after hours, gained about 5% on the trade.
Anthony, we are going out live via audio, but we are recording this for our own YouTube channel later. And you would you mind just adjusting your camera a little bit, and you can go? We can get you in the middle of the picture. There we go. That's a lot better. Okay, and just from your own perspective, Gins Global. I mean, you're a South African boy, we can hear that. You've been in the US now for quite some time. What drew you to focusing on the FANGs, on the tech stocks? And thank you for the information you send, not just to me, but to many people on a regular basis on things that are going. Because you've been on the money so often there. But where did it all start for you to go into that area?
Well, we realized that there's so many experts out there, Alec, on Wall Street, where I joined Wall Street back in 1990 at Solomon Brothers and then subsequently at Barclays, and realized very early on there are thousands literally of stock analysts out there. We became big index fund believers. We run ETFs. We run index funds, broad-based ones, global equity, regional equity ones, and also particularly in the tech and sector spaces. We realized quite early on that the tech area can be very tricky. And what we've tried to do is actually – yes, we cover mega caps, but we've also got equally weighted vehicles such as this tech megatrend ETF that's up about 45% just year over year. The last 3 months, it's up about 14%. And what we've tried to do there is to equally weight AI and cloud and cybersecurity, all these hot areas, electric vehicles. It's very hard to time it, Alec. But what we've also learned from our friends in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, including Elon and others, is the convergence across. You know, there's quite a lot of South African boykies, we call it the South African Mafia, ex-PayPal boys up there. They taught me and a few others a while ago, Anthony, don't just focus on AI or just on cloud or just on electric vehicles. We're converging. I mean, really, Tesla is essentially a robot on wheels. That's why it's valued at such a huge premium. And I know many people like Cy and others can't generally understand the valuation. But it's very hard to bet against what Elon's doing. But the real point is that things like cloud computing are first cousins to AI. The more NVIDIA grows, you look through the line items and you see the biggest expenditures and the biggest customers, frankly, are the cloud computing guys like AWS. That's Amazon Web Services, which is the big daddy. Google's actually ranked third at the moment in cloud. So for them to now have a 35% year-on-year gain in revenues means likely we'll see the rest of the cloud industry also gaining. In fact, the predictions are that cloud's going to grow at about a 28% compound growth rate right through the end of this decade. So the point is to really look at the overall convergence, even digital media, the likes of Netflix and the move towards gaming, where you see Netflix increasingly utilizing gaming now. There was this massive acquisition, you know, the biggest IT acquisition in the last 12 months, Alec, as you probably are aware, was blocked a number of times. But it went through eventually. This is Microsoft's sizable acquisition of Activision. And that just is trying to bring more eyeballs to Microsoft through social media and the digital entertainment.
So what about the rest of the week? It is a blockbuster week when you're looking at quarterly results. We've got Meta today. We've got Microsoft coming, and also Amazon. So four of the Magnificent Seven. We've had Google. You've given us, or Alphabet. We've had that insight. The market loved those numbers. Share price up. What are you looking for on the next three? And then their impact on NVIDIA, which only comes out in late November.
Right. It's very likely you'll see positive NVIDIA numbers based on just what we saw today with Alphabet's Google Cloud expenditure. We're looking for the line items of how much AWS later this week with Amazon are also spending on AI chips. Interestingly enough, even the likes of Microsoft with their Azure, which is actually the second largest player, will be crucial in that. So we're actually positive. You've got to remember, there's essentially a tailwind going on here in the US. Despite all the political mumbo-jumbo, most of what's going on here is relatively positive. We're expecting GDP numbers later today, Alec, of about 3.1% plus growth. So there's a lot of tailwind also with the interest rates coming down. We're expecting rate cuts in November and December. And I would say the treasurers and the CFOs are loosening their purse strings on technology spend. So many of the, even the second tier companies, not just the Magnificent Seven, but just the next tier down, we're expecting very positive earnings numbers. Interestingly enough, a weaker US dollar will also boost their earnings. And as you know, the dollar has weakened somewhat recently, so that should actually give them a little bit of an extra tailwind too. So, you know, ultimately, the sentiment here is positive. We're expecting a beat across the board from Meta as well as Amazon at this point.
When you mentioned a little earlier the growth in the cloud computing area for Alphabet last night, the big daddy in that area is Amazon. Given that somebody has to be losing market share, and they are by far the market leader there, is there concerns that maybe Amazon's numbers will disappoint in that very important field, Amazon Web Services, which is where they make most of their money?
Yes. Indeed, Amazon Web Services generates 50% almost of their quarterly profits now. So all the stuff my wife and others are buying up in their driveway, or that I'm buying, actually doesn't generates huge revenues for Jeff Bezos, but not much in the way of profit. Interestingly enough, Amazon's been encroaching on Google's search engine advertising business. And that was something interesting overnight we were all looking at. So Google's actually now below 50% in search advertising, Alex. So it's actually very interesting. So we think that Amazon's actually going to have bigger numbers on the advertising revenue numbers, and they should actually overcome any slight loss. Ultimately, they were the big daddy, over 40% market share in cloud. They're dripping down to about a 30% market share ultimately in cloud. So yeah, expect that to still drop. But ultimately, there's a big engine here. I mean, the economy, frankly, is doing far better than most of the world expected at this point. We've avoided a recession. There is a soft landing occurring as we speak. And I think that may be playing into the political atmosphere as well. It's interesting times. And just literally, the latest numbers on GDP today should predict possibly even as high as a 3.5% GDP growth number.
Anthony Ginsberg with Gins Global, joining us from Los Angeles in California. And we're very grateful to have him with us, taking us through those latest numbers. Gerard van Deventer joins us now. Gerard, lovely to have you. He's from the Financial Services Conduct Authority. He's the Divisional Executive for Enforcement. Yesterday on this program, we had a well-respected financial services executive. I know him. He preferred to be anonymous, who told us that it looks like Bankso, which you can unpack for us in just a moment, is back in business. Well, it's certainly got the same chief operating officer in this new company called Afrim Markets. Perhaps we can just go back a little bit, Gerard. You guys took a process to stop Bankso, which was allegedly pulling in customers through deep fake ads of Elon Musk, Johann Rupert, Nicky Oppenheimer, saying, hey, come and join me and make a lot of money. How does that process work from your perspective?
Yeah, good morning, Alec, and thank you for the opportunity to get some of this information out. Every little bit that can help public to make wiser decisions, we appreciate, and the media is an important partner in that. So, of course, this AI and deepfake scams is something that's very popular these days. We see a lot of it. We issue a lot of public warnings around it. And this case started because Immediate Matrix played exactly that role. They started the deepfake ads. And of course, the big thing always with that is such a telltale sign, and I can't say it enough, is the unrealistic returns. You know, Alec, you will, the adage, if it's too good to be true, it's because it's too good to be true. We can't say that enough. And of course, the vagueness about the product and the claim that they don't require an FECA license, those are all huge red flags. But anyway, started out, and our initial approach was that Immediate Matrix is impersonating banks. So, and there's a transfer of clients when you click on the link. But in the meantime, and we warned the public early about this, and we've warned the public again that we're investigating banks. So, of course, that investigation developed, and we are now focused on banks. So, but I must just say upfront, in fairness, anything that I say today must be understood against the background that our investigation is not completed. It's near completion. And when it is completed, we will provide banks with the opportunity to properly reply, and then we will make our findings. But because of the possible threat to the public and the possible threat to clients' funds, at some stage during the investigation, Alec, we approached the Financial Intelligence Center, brought this to their attention, and they froze, I think it's in the region of 90 million rand in bank accounts of Bankso. And that provided the opportunity, the temporary opportunity for us to then approach the National Prosecuting Authority, and more specifically the Asset Forfeiture Unit. And we've built up a very close relationship with them because this is not the first time. And they applied for a preservation order successfully. It's being appealed, but at this moment those funds are preserved or frozen, so to speak. At the same time, because of the evidence we already found, although the investigation is not completed, we also took the step of provisionally withdrawing the license of Bankso. And it's basically saying, we withdraw this license, we can talk about it again, but for now, let's finish this investigation and see what is going on. So that is where we are today. I'm also aware that over the weekend, I received notice that there's an application for the liquidation of Bankso as well by one of the investors. So that's another ongoing process. But, yeah, that's a process outside the FECA. So this is where we are today. We are really giving this the highest priority. I've got a team exclusively dedicated to it. And we will be taking the investigation further, and then we will decide on final sanctions. Of course, if there's, we will also bring this to the attention of the Hawks. It's already with the NPA, so to speak, because of the order. But of course, needless to say, when this happens, we do look at who are the directors, who are the key individuals, and we do look for those directors and key individuals' involvement in any other financial services providers. So we are aware of the AFRI markets issue, and we are looking at that.
The question we had yesterday, which we couldn't understand, was whether AFRI markets, which is following the Bankso playbook, appears to be anyway, is a clone of Bankso or a copycat. What was a bit of a giveaway was the chief operating officer is the same person in both companies, Mr. D'Andrade, or certainly that was what he was, what our informant was told. It seems, if that is the case, then it seems like it should be pretty easy to close down this business. But then there's the third party that you explained a bit earlier, which may be a parasite using those companies. Help us understand this better, if you would.
So both those options are, of course, very, very popular. Yes, you do see clones all the time. You even see scammers feeding on the fact that people has lost money. So they will contact people and say, I know you've lost money here. I can get it back for you, but you need to make a payment. And they sometimes impersonate us and my staff and I, and even my commissioner at some stage. Wow. But impersonation is certainly a possibility. But in the case of AfriMarkets, it is a separate entity with its own FSP license. But of course, I think it's probably public knowledge that, yes, the general manager is shared, and also the directors. So needless to say, it's part of our responsibility to look at that. It's too early to say where we're going with it or what the situation is. It's even too early to make any allegations on my side that AfriMarkets is doing anything wrong. But, Alec, if I can just say, generally speaking now, one of the most important things for FSCA when it comes to their financial services providers, and this is why we're giving this such a high priority, this is actually a licensed entity, and Banxa was until we withdrew the license. That always gets priority because it is our license and our name on that license, and it is supposed to create comfort for the public. So we protect that with everything we have. With reference to being an actual financial services provider, one of the big issues is suitability. Your anonymous whistleblower also spoke about it, but it's actually entrenched in law in our statutes. Suitability, very important. Mm. It's all about the risk mismatch or the risk match. So a guy at my age, you can't encourage or advise him to invest in high-risk investments. That would be just crazy. So that suitability when you give advice, so when you're encouraging people to trade, if you overstep that line, that's a big problem for the FSCA. And it's a simple situation. CFDs, trading in CFDs is a high-risk activity. You will agree with me, Alec, with that gearing effect. And the fact that it's an instrument that price can move very quickly, and the underlying, whether it's crypto, whether it's forex, in itself is already a high risk activity. Mm. So, in my view, you're looking at a double high risk type of investment here, only suitable for people with a really large investment portfolio and then only a small part of it. It is certainly not suitable for retired people, for people with a modest income, etc. And I think that is one of our issues that we are most definitely focusing on.
The problem here is that those who have large portfolios are not going to fall for deep fake ads. They look at it immediately and say, that's rubbish, and they will just move on. It's generally people who are not financially literate or as financially literate as they should be who get caught up. And our whistleblower said that it was Hashim Amla. Now, I wonder if Mr. Amla has any clue that his personality is being used to pull people in. And then what I suppose must worry all of us is the high-pressure salesmanship that happens thereafter, the phoning and so on. Where does one draw the line as the FSCA? What is an acceptable sales behavior and what is not?
Yeah, so let me start off with your first comment. You're so right. The people need to be aware of this type of situation, and it's the people that can afford it the least that gets pulled into it. So we have a huge effort to educate the public. We have a consumer education department. We spend millions on that grassroots level. I issue public warnings. I take every speaking engagement to repeat the fact that people must be very careful. But you are right. It's a vulnerable part of the community, and that makes it a huge problem and a priority for the FSCA in terms of case selection. So the line is very bright. There's no confusion about it. At all times, you must provide advice that is in the best interest of the client, and it must be with due care and diligence, and it must be suitable. So hard sell, cold calling, coupled with hard sell, that is not ideal. And that is not what we expect from our FSPs. There's also a real nasty turn to this whole thing. If you look at the founding affidavit, for instance, of the liquidation application, you will see it in action. But I'm once again going to speak generally. What we see quite often is that a person is convinced, talked hard sell, as you say, by cold calling, convinced into making high-risk investments. And sometimes there are real losses. Sometimes it's just theft. It's just fraud and theft. And then when that person is informed that he's lost, he or her lost the money, they are, of course, hysterical, and they are back against the wall. And then they will be told, well, if you commit more money, you can trade, or we can help you to trade out of the situation. So these poor people are sometimes hit with a second round of hard sell. Absolutely not acceptable. This is something that will make you lose your license. There's no doubt about it.
Gerard van Deventer is the Divisional Executive for Enforcement at the Financial Services Conduct Authority. There's a special place in hell, I hope, for those who take the savings of vulnerable people. We've seen in our business, we see too much of this, and we also see the consequences of it. Well, those who are on the other side of the coin right now, the investors in Bitcoin, are smiling rather than worrying about where their next meal might come from. And Jason Wells is the head of crypto at Jaltech. Jason, good to be talking with you. We know Jaltech well. It's a BizNews partner. You guys are a reputable business. I'm happy that we've had a long relationship with you, and as a result, I'm sure that you would feel just as strongly as BizNews does and as the Financial Services Conduct Authority does about these high-pressure salespeople in organizations like Bankso, whether they Bankso is an innocent party or not. But when it comes to crypto, when it comes to your field, is there any particular advice that you can give to people before they invest in Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's prudent to understand that crypto is, despite its high promise, it is still probably the riskiest asset class you can invest in at this stage. Never invest more than you can afford to lose. And as a tried and true method for investing in volatile assets, dollar cost averaging is really any investor's friend in this market. I don't think anybody who's we're sitting at all-time highs right now, but anybody in the history of Bitcoin's life who has embarked on a dollar cost averaging approach to investment has pretty much never seen any significant drawdown on their investment. So that would be my very high level advice.
Explain that, because you've used a word called drawdown, which means losses. You guys in financial services come up with interesting terms, but dollar cost averaging, how does that work?
Cool. So dollar cost averaging, really, I mean, the dollar doesn't really need to be there, but it's essentially just spreading out an investment instead of doing a big lump sum investment to do an investment over a longer period of time so that you're not beholden to where the price is at any moment in time. Say, for instance, you invested right now in Bitcoin, you put R1 million in, and Bitcoin obviously doesn't, or potentially doesn't do well over the next month. You might be sitting on a 20% drawdown and you might be thinking, this is not the market I want to be in. Whereas if you take a more long-term approach, you invest slowly over a long period of time, each one of those investments will not necessarily be so beholden to individual or the market conditions at that individual point in time. And you basically, you give up your opportunity to make massive outsized returns. But at the same time, you give up the potential of making massive losses as a result of bad market timing. So, and for a volatile market where you have a strong thesis on the long-term value of an asset, that approach makes a lot of sense. You capture a lot of that upside without taking on any undue risk.
I guess a lot of people would understand that from the unit trusts, where they've got a debit order that goes in every month, R1,000 a month, and then they'll see 1 month they buy more units and the next month they buy less, given the price movement. But tell us about Bitcoin. It's had a phenomenal run. I'm looking at the, as we're talking, I'm having a look at the graph. This year alone, Bitcoin year to date has risen 63%. We're sitting at, as you say, 72,000. I'm not sure if that's an all-time high, but it'd be very close to an all-time high right now. What's causing it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's quite important to kind of set the stage. This rally isn't anything new. It's not something that started in 2024. I think it really started in the depths of the 2022 bear market. But kind of to set the stage, there's been a few things earlier this year that have been very supportive of crypto as an asset class. Firstly, we had the ETFs, spot Bitcoin ETFs launching back in January, the most successful ETF launches of all time. That has unlocked a new set of investors who previously weren't comfortable investing into Bitcoin due to the self-custody risks and counterparty risks involved. Secondly, we had the halving in April, which was a supply shock for Bitcoin. But I think more relevant to the recent rally have been a few high-profile endorsements from players in the traditional finance space. I think Larry Fink comes to mind, who on the BlackRock earnings call, was it last month or earlier this month, explicitly mentioned Bitcoin as a long-term competitor to gold and as a gold-like asset. Though very more acutely and over the last couple of days specifically, I think a lot has turned on. So we've got this really supportive environment, also supported by macroeconomic conditions and an easing cycle, but a growing expectations that Trump has a very good chance of taking the presidency in the U.S. He has explicitly said that he will start a Bitcoin reserve for the U.S. government if he comes into power. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But a Trump presidency would be a little bit more pro-crypto than a Democrat presidency, with the Republican Party being generally pro-nation. And at the same time, any sort of outcome of the U.S. election is going to be driving an increase to the government deficit there and generate a little bit of inflationary pressure, while also kind of portending some risks to the dollar as the global reserve currency, though that's probably a much longer story. And I think the clue there to look at is gold is also at all-time highs, right? And despite interest rates, so the back end of the yield curve, if you look at long-term interest rates, they're picking up despite us being in an easing cycle. And that's kind of, for me, illustrative that the market is pricing in some sort of fiscal cliff for the U.S. government.
Or inflation, in other words.
Essentially, they're going to have to start monetizing the debt to get out of their debt situation, which shouldn't be supportive of any hard assets like gold or Bitcoin.
Jason, you've given us a lot of insights. On the other hand, though, it's $72,279 per Bitcoin. Would you be buying them right now?
I personally do a dollar cost averaging approach for my long-term investment holdings. I mean, I do a little bit of trading on the side. I'm not a successful trader. I do it for fun. I'm doing it. But in my long-term retirement savings, do it a dollar cost average into crypto.
So you'd put a certain amount aside every month, and if it goes to 72,000 or 272,000 or $72, it doesn't matter. You believe in the
entirely
asset class,
price agnostic.
And you keep.
Yeah, I think 10 years from now, it's going to be a good investment in my view. I've got no problems buying at any of these prices.
Jason Welts is the head of crypto at Jeltec, and booming Bitcoin is something that you've got to take account of. In the BizNews portfolio, we put 2% of the portfolio into Bitcoin, which is probably a good number. That 2% has suddenly become 8%. That's in the Shift portfolio. And for those of you who wonder what I'm talking about with portfolios, we do have two model portfolios. We update them every month. We have a webinar. It was yesterday, but it's only for BizNews Premium members. Yeah, we got to fund the business somehow. You must realize that. Thank you for being with us today. I look forward to being back in your company again, same time, same place, tomorrow, from our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, our executive producer, Lucy Ferreira. Thanks, guys. Great program again. And yours truly, Alec Hogg. Look forward to being back in your company again at 7 a.m. sharp tomorrow morning. Until then, cheerio.